Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With every episode, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back.
Welcome back.
We are coming at you today with a slice of 90s life. We are covering 90s teen horror on account of, like, it was a genre that came to light when we were both kind of in our formative years. You're a little bit younger than I am, but we were both kind of the, like, X-Files first run on TV, then come Dawson's Creek, and all of a sudden we're speaking a lot hipper than 16-year-olds were when our parents were 16-year-olds.
Absolutely. Yeah, something like, I don't know. Hipper? I don't know. Do kids say that? Who knows?
So this will be part one of our 90s horror teen slasher. I'll get that right eventually. But so we're going to be talking about culture and the first sort of dipping back into the pool with I Know What You Did Last Summer. And for our intents and purposes, what they're talking about is the better movie from the summer before, 1996's Scream. I'm thinking back to, like, just being a little bit of a film nerd. In the late 60s and early 70s, when independent film kind of really did new things, we're talking the kinds of movies that are covered in the documentary Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood. Those indie movies, when Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper go off with a bunch of burnout friends and hippies and make a movie that captures them speaking as they speak, acting as they act, that connected with a generation of people. And it was familiar, and it was great, and Hollywood capitalized it, and they, of course, you know, do what they do. They wanted to sell tickets. They commodified it and turned it into product. I kind of feel like Kevin Williamson didn't define how young people were talking. He might have touched a little bit, just enough to be familiar, but then elevating it. Like, then there's this exaggerated, ultra-hip way to speak, and so life starts imitating culture.
Yeah, 1996 kicks off that Scream Kevin Williamson, like, powerhouse of teen kind of movies. And the year before that, 1995, is when the WB even becomes a channel. And to me, when I think of these 90s horror films, I think of the WB because it's this idea of this WB culture. Did you watch WB in the 90s? How old were you, Darren?
I was born in 81, so say Scream comes out in 96. I was 15 years old when I saw it in the theater. You know what? Come to think of it, as a rated R movie. I don't remember what parent got us in there, but I thankfully had some older friends and older sisters.
I did not see it in the theater because I was 13 years old, but we rented it from Blockbuster.
Oh, better. I was trying to think to myself, like, what was the appeal of Dawson's Creek?
I tried to rewatch it recently. It's available, you know, on streaming services now. And yeah. I tried to rewatch it. I was like, yeah, I mean, I watched a few episodes of this. I enjoyed it until that blonde girl came, and I didn't really care for her. And
that Oscar-winning blonde woman. That
she's the worst part of the show.
Michelle Williams, really?
No, Andy, another character. Sorry, it's another
later.
Person.
Okay.
It's like, I don't think it's good. And I love 90s things. You know, I love the 90s, but I don't. And I love WB garbage. I love it. But I don't care for Dawson's Creek. I do not.
I think at the time, it's funny to think that it was hip, but it was. It was a trendsetter. So much so that, like, we've talked about this, how at the end of these shows, they would often have, like, music for this episode is brought to you by Blink 182 and whatever. Like, whatever music played in the show was going to sell albums the next day. That's how strong the
Dawson's Creek
was.
Actually ended up doing. Dawson's Creek went hand in hand with J. Crew, and they literally had a very exclusive credit with J. Crew at the end of the episode. So you would know, like, oh, all these clothes came from J. Crew.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
That's amazing.
It's pretty gross. I think back then they would just call it synergy.
Yes. But isn't that, like, wild? And, yeah, I remember WB being like, oh, if you liked this song, here's the new album by, I don't know, like, Biff Naked or something. I'm trying to name something that's, like, very 90s. And you'd be like, yes, please. Yes, I would.
Yeah, no, we're going to be diving deep through the 90s references pretty soon.
You know how I like the library, and now I like the online library, which I always liked because I didn't like getting out of my bed or wearing pants. So online library, you can find so much on, like, Realm and stuff, you know. Found an article in 1998 by Adweek. Don't even know what that is. I don't think that's a magazine anymore.
I think it still is. I, in our school, going through graphic design, yeah, Adweek is just, you're up to date. I mean, this particular article talks about, like, the ad sales of commercial time for the 90s. So this is ultra specific.
Yes. So 1998, written by Nicole Rosenthal, it's called The Boom Tube, and it is about that WB 90s Gen Y kind of culture. And this was before they called Gen Y millennials. And so they're still calling it Generation Y. And I'd be so interested. I should have looked up how old Nicole Rosenthal was when she wrote this, because there's a little bit of, like, snark to it. So I would say she's probably, like, a Gen Xer writing this. It's an interesting article, and it talks about that idea of that synergy between the commercialism of these WB shows or of this Kevin Williamson brand. And what you have to keep in mind is that this group of kids, it's in this article talking about, this group of kids, 10 to 19-year-olds in 1997, so 10-year-olds to 19-year-olds, spent
us.
$91 billion in 1997.
Of their parents' money.
That's amazing. Previous to that, 10 years previous, 10 to 19-year-olds. So then 1987, you're talking, like, the height of John Hughes and that kind of mall kind of culture. They spent more than half less.
Wow.
That's amazing. That's a huge difference. And this is a group of kids who, now that we're older, we've been through many recessions and now apocalypse. But at that time, you know, we had the world by the, I don't know, what's that phrase? Oyster? What? I don't know. I think I've been watching too much Kevin Williamson, and I'm thinking about East Coast oysters. But they really kind of had this money that they could just spend on whatever.
That idea of middle class surge, the disposable income amongst teenagers, I feel like it's kind of part and parcel with some of the subtext to these stories in terms of this changeover from the 80s, where there have been 5 Halloweens, 5 Nightmare on Elm Streets, and 8 Friday the 13th. And all of those are a singular character that means different things to different people, but it always comes back to them. It always comes back to your Freddies, your Jasons, your Michael Myers. And during White Flight, when all of a sudden suburbs really emerge, these stories are primarily white. And, you know, I think there is a subtext of, like, white flight and this need for comfort and security among people who look like you and act like you and spend like you. These stories are now an anonymous killer. It's a throwback to, like, the 70s and before, where who is this person? What does it have to do with you? Why is this person going after their neighbors, right? These stories aren't about city kids invading the suburbs. This is right. A killer amongst them. The call is coming from inside the house.
And that is what oftentimes in Kevin Williamson's writing, this lovely little town on the East Coast, and everyone's wearing, well, J. Crew. I think maybe today I would say everyone's wearing Vineyard Vines or something. And yes, the thought that someone in their small community, where everyone knows everyone else, is killing people is like, ooh, even scarier. Part of the idea of this mid to late 90s culture is a reflection and an antithesis of kind of that grunge culture. So in the way that grunge was fighting against hair metal, let's say, then you got your grunge. Now we've got these polished kids. And these kids are kind of kids who, I don't know, normally you'd be like, but that's the Molly Ringwald of the 80s. And you wouldn't necessarily root for that character. In the 90s, though, you kind of do, especially in I Know What You Did Last Summer. One of the main characters is a beauty queen and the most popular girl. Usually that person is kind of made fun of nowadays, and even in the John Hughes kind of. But in this late 90s, you really idolize these jocks or these kids that were not only doing jock or beauty pageant things, but also they were top of their class and these just wholesome American kids.
Yeah, it occurred to me later, we're going to talk about the Faculty, but it like grunge became an aesthetic to be purchased at Hot Topic. Like even the early days of like Bedhead, and there's, you know, literally right the hair stuff called Bedhead.
Yes, it's true.
This general wave of commercialization really touched every aesthetic. There's a couple lines in the article that really stood out to me. This idea that advertisers were on top of this. From the moment they start seeing trends move, they jumped on. This is a quote. Advertisers are realizing more and more the value of this consumer, says Jack Washlag, head of research at the WB. Quote, with Generation X, there weren't enough of them. Generation Y, not only are there lots more of them, they have more money to spend. Among the four networks, there's not enough inventory skewing young. That's our whole focus. So that line, I don't know, well, Mindy, you're a little bit younger, but in the early days of Fox, when like The Simpsons and Married with Children are some of the only original programming. I mean, Cops.
Yeah, I remember
Cops
that.
Cops found its origin in Fox because they just needed programming.
And I remember Fox, we had to like turn the channel, there's channel 27 out here, and you had to like adjust the ears, the rabbit ears. I couldn't even think of what that word was, because Fox wasn't even like as strong as the other like things. And so if you wanted to watch not even The Simpsons, what was that before the show that The Simpsons
Tracy
came
Ullman
from?
Show.
Yes, the Tracy Ullman show. You had to like adjust the rabbit ears or maybe put that tinfoil up there. But yeah, and these like crazy shows, you remember, I don't know if you remember, but like Whoops, Gary Shandling was on there for a while. It's a fun kind of thing. And but that was a completely different era and catered to a very different thing than the WB came around at a time when the standard TV had 45 channels. Your standard cable, I mean to say, had 45 channels to compete with. So WB had to come from somewhere and really make its mark somewhere.
And skewing young is a good way. I mean, if you're an advertiser, they talk about making like lifelong brand allegiances. Like that's when you want to get a kid to commit when they're a teenager and they're still kind of, their brains are not quite fully developed.
There was something the article talks about that made me really kind of think, because I did grow up in this culture and I feel like I know this culture. I'm sure you do too. But part of what they were catering to was teen girls more than guys, than boys. And it was because of this idea of latchkey culture. And the article goes into it to say that oftentimes young girls were buying groceries for their family. Hmm. Not with their money. Their parents gave them the money, but they were the ones going to the store and doing this because latchkey culture, they were home first. And so what you would have then, oftentimes in magazines, you saw this real shift in the mid to late 90s of instead of having cooking products in the advertisements, like on the back covers, you started seeing CoverGirl, or you started seeing your things that did cater to younger women. And that was because those girls were the ones standing in line because of this new kind of culture.
In our episode 100, we did a deep dive on Scream, and I think down the line, I'd certainly like to cover the series of films and even the TV show, which I've taken a liking to lately.
I wondered how that was.
Yeah, it's working out. In any case, we've covered Scream. We are taking at face value the impact that Scream had, and moving from the summer of 1996 with Scream, we ourselves are starting off with I Know What You Did Last Summer, which is perfectly named given the context. But in the summer of 1997, Jim Gillespie directed Jennifer Love Hewitt, Sarah Michelle Gellar, Ryan Phillippe, and Freddie Prinze Jr. Now it feels like more of a poster than a movie.
Yeah, well, so many of these, because of how they were marketed, kind of were. It's quick on being slick and looking nice, but the substance sometimes is lacking. And so sometimes I kind of forgot most of this movie until I watched it. And I go, oh, yeah, I vaguely remember this, but it wasn't really, didn't come back to me that much.
Yeah, I think I had watched it through once, and that was it. And since then I've seen bits and pieces, but I didn't like it all that much the first time around. And honestly, I liked it even less this time around.
Really? Oh, did you hate all three movies?
No.
Okay, good.
I think as we talk through them, you'll see that I like them as they matured. I will say that this is the little brother of these movies in terms of, like, I don't know, maturity, development, all those things.
Fair.
Just getting started. At this point, though, all of these people had been on TV or films in some capacity. Jennifer Love Hewitt was in Party of Five, and she's been acting for forever. Sarah Michelle Gellar also acting from the time she was really young. Ryan Phillippe, I don't think he had done TV before this, but apparently in his audition he knocked it out of the park. Like, his role was supposed to be like quarterback looking jock, and he is track star looking torpy looking guy.
Good looking guy, you mean. I had the biggest crush on Ryan Phillippe, and I still do. I don't care.
That's
whatever.
Funny. He had Justin Timberlake hair before Justin Timberlake.
Oh yeah, but it wasn't like crispy, I feel. Whatever. Don't come after Ryan Phillippe.
I actually really do like him. The Way of the Gun is a pretty dope movie. And then Freddie Prinze Jr., who is the son of Freddie Prinze, the comedian and tragic comedic actor. But yeah, so all of these kids. Oh, and John Galecki, who, you know, is in Big Bang Theory, and I always know him as David from Roseanne.
Me too, and that's how I'll remember him. Thank you.
So we've got recognizable teens. We've got, I mean, even just the name of the movie is kind of like, hey, did you like Scream? Well, I know you did. I know what you did last summer.
You watched my movie.
We were doing market research. So we know what you did last summer. But yeah, so script by Kevin Williamson, adapted from Lois Duncan's 1973 teen suspense novel. So the original writer, Lois Duncan, displeased with this movie. Apparently this...
very displeased.
In all fairness, it was a novel. It was a young adult novel in 1973. Kevin Williamson used some of it, but turned it more from a like suspense crime style whodunit into a slasher with a killer fisherman.
Yes.
So I get her being upset by it. And the story gets weird and convoluted, where she actually lost a daughter to a violent crime. So the idea that like this movie kind of betrayed her, and you know, it just compounds the awfulness. But this is one of the things that she said in response. I was ecstatic until I settled into a theater seat with my box of popcorn and discovered that Hollywood had turned my teenage suspense story into a slasher film. The setting had been changed from the mountains of New Mexico to a fishing village on the East Coast. I would say barely. It's worse crime. So an insane fisherman who wasn't in my book could decapitate my characters with an ice hook.
Well, to be fair, he didn't decapitate everybody. To be really fair, Lois Duncan. She didn't care for that. And that's too bad when someone takes something and makes your art something very different. I get that, but I mean, it's 1997, and like probably this kind of brought a resurgence to Lois Duncan's work. I think I read Down a Dark Hall because of this.
Oh, okay. So apparently Kevin Williamson wrote this before he wrote Scream, and it does feel a little premature. It's like he kind of reuses a couple elements that you can like almost line up scenes as far as how they play out. But I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. You know, it was just starting his career.
Right. Can we please talk about the soundtrack? Oh, my God. It's amazing. Oh, have you? I rarely watch movies like on my laptop, mm-hmm. and I rented them on Amazon. You can touch like the screen and it tells you who's in each scene and it tells you like little helpful hints about what's happened, like continuity
errors. IMDb trivia.
And it tells you the soundtrack. Yeah. And it tells you the soundtrack that's playing.
Yeah. Yeah. I found out recently I was doing just a sort of summary of what it means to be a Monopoly for my students, and Amazon, you know, Jeff Bezos' crew, own IMDb. So my Amazon tablet, when I play anything on Amazon Prime, I discovered that pretty early, that it'll show you the cast and any IMDb trivia, as well as any score that's playing in the middle of the scene.
Well, that's amazing.
But yeah, that 90s synergy where it wasn't enough to have a movie that maybe that movie is going to have a theme song. But no, there's going to be a mixtape to go with it. There's going to be an album with hits from the movie. I feel like in the 90s, you got a lot of musicians' B-sides for these movies.
Yes.
So on that note of music, there's a track in this movie that I became aware of, and this is going to be one of the most 90 things I ever said. I saw the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones at the Warped Tour for a number of years in a row.
Amazing.
That said, they never released this particular track called Wake Up. They certainly never played it live, and so when I heard it on a Warped Tour compilation album, I was like, that's a really good song. Why have I never heard this? Why is it only on this compilation? And then it shows up on the I Know What You Did Last Summer soundtrack. And it, in fact, is the song that's playing when the movie kind of hits the crux, so to speak. But so in probably around the year 2000, I was in San Francisco going to art school, and I went to see the Boss Tones. They came through town, and they were playing the Bottom of the Hill Club, which pretty far outside the central city, took some time to get there. And the Boss Tones are on this tiny little stage. And if anybody's ever seen the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones live,
there's 50 of
them. Yeah, there's a baker's dozen of those guys kicking around the stage, including a hired dancer, the Boss Tone, who dances on stage and sings backup. So it was crowded. It was a small venue. So when the show's over, Dickie Barrett, one of the greatest people alive, goes to the bar and is chilling with the fans after the show, at which point, you know, I get a moment to buy him a drink and chew on his ear for a minute and ask about this song that I love and I've never heard them play and I've never seen it pop up anywhere else. And he's the one who tells me that, it's this random song, it didn't really fit. However, it is the song that kills the fisherman in I Know What You Did Last Summer. It's the song that's playing when Ryan Phillippe is playing I'm the King of the World outside of the sunroof and Freddie Prinze Jr. hits the stranger on the road. And that really tripped me out. But I kind of loved having that moment with like this, you know, musician who I love to death. And yeah, I don't know. If there is like a warm place in my heart for this movie, it's entirely because of the music.
Nice. I think for me, the best part of the movie is Jennifer Love Hewitt's acting. You mentioned she was on Party of Five with Nev Campbell. The style of acting is exactly the same. It's the same style of acting. I like when Nev Campbell does it. I don't like when Jennifer Love Hewitt does it. I don't know why I don't care for them equally,
What are you seeing? Because I tried to find this connecting tissue and I couldn't.
They kind of like open their mouth kind of and raise their eyebrows up and like, huh? And then like breathe kind of through their mouth. Yeah, exasperated sort of. And then you could imagine if they had sleeves on, their hands would be like deep down into their sleeves. So only maybe their fingertips would be poking out. And then they get real little and then they I can't believe you don't see it. It's exactly the same. If you closed your eyes, you would think it was the same. Especially in the scene, what is the big line?
What are you waiting for, huh? What are you waiting for?
I die laughing every fucking time. It's so bad. So bad. Did you also, like, I found myself watching it, like, do you think that probably the character of Ray can't read?
Look, he's after me too.
Is that, that's Freddie Prinze Jr.'s character?
I got a letter.
Yeah.
I might have guessed. I love that as like a character, like he's figuring it out for himself. He's like, you know what? I think my character's illiterate. I'm
Which I know I'm going to jump ahead, and I maybe have mentioned it on the show before, but later we're going to talk about Urban Legend and Jared Leto. And one of the most like dumbest, I say many dumb things to myself quite often, but one of the worst things I ever thought was when 30 Seconds to Mars had like a video on, and I looked and I was like, for a guy who can't read, he's really done a lot.
Because Jordan Catalano was illiterate.
But Jared Leto can read. Maybe, probably. I don't actually know. He looks like a reader. But I don't know about Freddie Prinze Jr. I'm a little confused. I still don't know, but I think maybe the character can't. I don't know. There's a scene in the opening where they take the girls out to tell them scary stories. Is this a thing? Did you ever do this in the 90s? Is this a thing that you did to impress girls?
No. I think this is like a Nantucket-ish kind of beach community, or fishing community, rather. I think the beach is just kind of where they go for a little bit of privacy. And in this case, like, what? It was after the party, right? So they've tied one on. They're going to the beach to, like, you know, make up a fire and talk about scary urban legends.
No, he wasn't decapitated. He was gutted with a hook.
Yeah, I just, I never had this experience as a kid to try and, like, have someone scare you. Because, firstly, I was scary as shit in high school, so no one was going to scare me.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, it's pretty typical. Teenage boys, like, yeah, you scare girls, get their blood pumping, get their adrenaline going, and they might make some mistakes. So Ryan Phillippe ties one on. He's the rich kid. It's funny how much the, say, like, the 80s archetype of the Breakfast Club, and it's going to come into play more so when we talk about the Faculty, but these teenage characters, we've got Sarah Michelle Gellar as the pageant winner. We've got Jennifer Love Hewitt's going to move away to, well, she's going to go to college and become a lawyer. Ryan Phillippe, of course, is going to become a professional football player, quarterback.
Yes.
And Freddie Prinze Jr. is going to learn how to read. I don't
know. Yeah, I don't remember why he
they
was
talk
doing.
About him moving to New York and maybe being a writer. I don't, something like that. But in any case.
Well, he needs to learn how to read first.
So Ryan Phillippe, while kind of twerpy, plays a great kind of rich kid scumbag.
Of course he does. And then later it's honed in for Cruel Intentions, his best movie ever.
You know, I was thinking about that and that as a potential rant sequitur because I've never seen Cruel Intentions.
Oh my God. Love that movie. Okay. Okay, go on. Sorry. Don't get me started.
So Ryan Phillippe, of course, is kind of responsible for the car accident, even though Freddie Prinze Jr. is driving. There is a guy in the middle of the road on like a waterside drive, like a hillside drive. So there's not really, even if the guy was on the shoulder of the road, there's nothing there. There should not be a person there. But they hit him. This is now when they've got some decisions to make because this moment's going to define the rest of their lives.
It's very similar to Tommy Boy when they put the dead deer in the car and then it comes back to life, though. And so that's where this all goes wrong.
Right. That, I guess that could have been the alternative. But I guess in theory, they did put him in the car because they took him to the dock.
Yeah, I don't think they walked him down that hill. A body is heavy and a supposedly dead body is probably worse.
Yeah. And so Jennifer Love Hewitt kind of recognizes that if there's blood on the car, then there's car on this bloody guy. They're going to connect the dots. They're going to track them down. They should just go straight to the police and fess up. the rest of the group disagrees. So she loses out, and they talk about checking his wallet.
Should we check his wallet and see who he is?
Why?
I don't know, okay? Just to know.
I forgot about
that. That would have been a good move. Who knows? Maybe this guy is the world record holder for holding your breath underwater.
You don't know. Could be David Blaine. Could be.
So, yeah, so that being the sort of catalyst, I will say if this movie has interesting dynamics to it, the idea that we are beginning this story with trauma and none of these characters prosper, like all their dreams about what was going to come after high school, all those kind of bleed away. Like they're an alcoholic, in depression, stuck in the same old job, like their lives haven't turned out great.
No, it's not working out so well for them. I think Johnny Galecki is probably the only person who like didn't have any aspirations. So he's like right on track.
Yeah. Johnny Galecki is your small town. He's a townie, and he doesn't like Ryan Phillippe, and he doesn't like the guys associated with him, the girls he likes. But so
yes.
he makes an early appearance at the party. And then he drives by and they kind of play it off well enough that he's unsuspecting of what happened. However, when he is brought back into the story, we'll go from there. But so a year after, last summer, Jennifer Love Hewitt comes home. She is just about ready to fail out of college, it seems. Like depression has really gotten the worst of her. Although, I mean, she never comes off as in such bad state.
Right. Her roommate's still like very friendly to her. So like she can't be shitty all the time.
Yeah. Better roommate than Urban Legend, which is coming up.
Yes.
Once she's home and she's probably gotten the first good home cooked meal and good night's sleep in a long time, just in time to get a death threat. I don't know. It's someone letting her know that they know what she did last summer. And I think this is a bad sign for the rest of the story because of the people who might know what she did last summer, there's exactly four people, not including her, right? They're right. Her friends who were involved, and there's the one guy who kind of drove by so it at least could put her in a place during a disappearance if later, I don't know, that news story gets written. But yeah, it's a pretty small cast of who this could be. And you never really get the feeling that it's one, I don't know. Did you ever feel it was for?
Never. No. Even when they kind of make that a thing. No, of course, everyone thinks it's.
Yeah, I think that kind of takes me out of it pretty early. Like, I wasn't really feeling like they're giving me the clues to figure this out on my own.
I feel like they actually don't. Right. Like, you know how it's supposed to be a great suspense novel actually gives you the clues and then you figure it, like if you rewatch it, you should be like, all along you knew.
Yeah.
This does not do that.
No. When the killer, presents as a killer, this is one of the elements that took me out of it. How do you feel about the killer fisherman look with a slicker and a hook?
I don't feel any way. I'm from Illinois. I've never seen a person dressed like that in my life. That's so far from the normal. It would make no sense.
You're right.
If we saw someone dressed like that, of course they're a killer. It's the Morton Salt guy. We would. In the Midwest, we don't wear slickers.
But yeah.
That's
it. It's a really specific look that doesn't really... I don't know. You know what? I think all three of these movies do kind of suffer from like a pretty weak villain aesthetic. And we'll talk about Urban Legends and just kind of how like the film just kind of got screwed by the timeline of the production. But in this case, small town being tormented by a killer fisherman. I mean, and the hook isn't a new thing at this point. Candyman had already come out. And before that, there's 80s slashers with the mutilator and a lot. There's a lot of hooks. There's not anything all that interesting or unique about this.
Also, it seems like a really hard way to kill somebody because it's not like it's a sickle. It's like a hook.
Right. It's
really only good for hooking, not for like really slicing.
Yeah. I noticed that there is one specific direction that Hook needs to be going if it's going to kill or even stick. Otherwise, it's just a whacking implement.
Yeah, you're just like kind of sort of hitting me with a metal thing, which would hurt. Yes, but it's so short. He doesn't have like a lot of like torque he can give it.
I will say the first on-screen kill, not counting the car, is a pretty good one. I think it's the one like... I think the moment you see Fisherman and his hook, you're kind of looking out for that one hand. It's like Freddy. It's like he's not going to kill you with his weak, non-gloved hand. Just keep away from the hook. And so before this particular character knows what's going on, that hook whips up and catches him under the jaw. It's a good one. That was pretty good gore.
I kind of did like most of the deaths, though, even though they... couldn't have exactly happened with it. I enjoyed a lot of it. Yeah. I like a specific trunk opening scene very much. Thank you. I like many things. I love the alley, right outside of the parade. It's one of my most favorite things because they could have gotten help, but they were literally 10 feet away from help.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. That was pretty good.
That's great. That's great to me.
So not saying who that was, however, well, it's funny, like, you know, this movie is over 20 years old, but...
Yeah, if you haven't seen it by now, I kind of like, meh, but it's
we're
okay.
Still going light on the spoilers. Completely unrelated, of course. Sarah Michelle Gellar is pretty funny in this, considering her character is not supposed to be like the ham of the group, the slapstick one. No, she is kind of your... pageant winning pretty girl with wit, and she's got some pretty dark but like really funny moments.
What if they're waiting for us? What if they recognize us? They could have a gun, shoot us dead.
It's been a year, Helen. They could have done that already.
You know, Jodie Foster tried this in a skin ripping serial killer answered the door.
I love her. She is really funny.
Yeah, and there is, yeah, it came up a lot. Who literally wrote the book on this stuff is Alex West from the Faculty of Horror. She wrote the book, The 90s Teen Horror Cycle, Final Girls, and a New Hollywood Formula. And she talks specifically about how, in this case, like Sarah Michelle Gellar is not a stereotype. Like she went from being, you know, ideally pretty in a high school setting. So like she went from being top of the high school hierarchy to just another person who needs a job in town. And like, you kind of see that heartbreak in her. Like she had her eyes set on New York and acting and being a star, and she didn't get any of it. And her life is one of those that is just kind of, it stopped moving forward that summer.
I love when Jennifer Love Hewitt comes back and they all are meeting up again. And that second summer, Sarah Michelle Gellar, the clothes that she's wearing, and I know that it's the 90s, so it is obviously very dated, but she looks like a sad housewife kind of, you know, she's like smoking cigarettes. She's got like overdone hair, overdone makeup. And it's like, oh, this is, you're settling in your role is like, this is how you're going to be as an adult now, you know? And it to me is like, really well done.
Yeah. Day wine mom, like the...
yeah, right?
Open the door now! Please, please, please!
I'm coming.
Elsa!
Her older sister, played by Bridget Wilson Sampras, is... It's funny. She's the only mean girl in this movie. And
she's so mean.
Yeah, and like...
I was hoping she was the killer, to be fair, but I knew it wasn't true, but I really had hoped.
That would have been an interesting approach. I mean, they would have had to do more work in terms of the story, but yeah, as far as like characters...
Would they have?
Well, I mean, they wouldn't have been able to cram it into one paragraph of exposition in the third act. But yeah, there's a couple great chase moments. SMG, she's scrappy. She's scrappy. I like her. And she's got a good scream.
Oh, yeah. She's great at this. What's funny is I'm so used to her and I think of her as Buffy. And so then when she does get into like a fight, you're like, well, I mean, just kick his ass. You know,
you kill vampires, for God's sakes.
Jesus Christ. You could just do a flip. Do a flip.
I think there was a moment where she was talking to the director about how she does her own stunts on Buffy, and they started giving her more of that stuff to do on her own. Anne Heche is introduced as the sister of the guy they killed, maybe. But she's particularly good at playing twitchy, eerie, maybe kind of backwoods methy.
Yeah, she's good. She's a good one. And wearing some weird schmata and like her hair's going all over the place.
Yeah, yeah. She was a character. I think she kind of stands out in this story as like, oh, all right, someone's taking this seriously.
Oh, good. There's an adult here.
But yeah, so going back to Buffy, when the killer fisherman starts tormenting these people, and that's kind of the point of this. He is tormenting them. He is cutting off hair. He is stealing Ryan Phillippe's jacket and driving his car into a building.
It's like, a general nuisance, really.
Yeah, he's not. And that's the thing that, like, I don't know, there's any number of places where this story could have built up tension and momentum, but when you just kind of focus on torturing these characters, and I don't mean torture in the later 90s, early 2000s torture porn way. I mean just in like, yeah, he's scaring them and getting them worried that, I don't know, they might die if this guy changes his mind and becomes more aggressive. But in any case, how he takes it out on Sarah Michelle Gellar is by cutting her hair in her sleep, to which she has a really intense reaction. And I wondered, Mindy, when you're watching that, I would imagine there's a pretty dramatic difference between you watching that and me watching that. Does it feel violating, that scene?
So I'm not a hair girl. Some girls, you know, cry when they get their hair cut. Like adult people who I know who like have jobs and are relatively normal functioning people. But if their hair gets cut like 2 inches when the hairdresser said they were only going to do 1 inch, they'll cry. So I don't have that hair reaction. It doesn't bother me because, you know, like 10 years ago, I just cut all my hair off. I don't know. I don't have the same reaction. And I honestly think it looked better cut, you know, her hair. But that's the thing. And then she gets it done that same day and it looks amazing. And you're like, great. This is for the best, SMG.
So there is that short period of time before she gets the like proper haircut where Ryan Phillippe is comforting her and Jennifer Love Hewitt shows up after finding a body in her trunk, and it's,
I like that scene,
been dead long enough that it's got crabs crawling every which way. We're going to talk more about this a little bit when we go full spoilers at the very end. We're going to include this, but this killer, if nothing else, has a aptitude for a quick cleanup.
So good at cleaning. Because that's impossible.
It's a weird approach. It just as far as like, I don't know, maybe I'm overthinking it. But if I'm a killer, how much emphasis am I going to put on that little moment of torment where she runs to SMG and Ryan Phillippe and lets them know there's a body in my trunk and we all know who it is. And then they get there and the body's not there anymore. So kind of gaslighting.
Don't even. He was there, God damn it, and he was wearing your jacket, Barry.
Where'd he go? Did the crabs carry him away?
I swear to God.
I believe you.
He took the body. He came and he took the body.
Why would he do that?
I don't know. Barry, okay, why would he try to run you over? Why did he make coleslaw on Helen's head? He's fucking with us.
That's a relief, if nothing else. Like, that's...
Oh, good. I'm just crazy. But like the smell would still be there. There's no freaking way you could take a dead body and a bunch of crabs out of a trunk and there's no smell.
No.
Even if you line that thing with plastic, I've thought about this. I've thought about how he could have done it. I assume he used like Visqueen and lined it with plastic, put the body in, then quickly like grabbed it all out and got it out in the suburbs where no one saw him do that in the middle of the day. Doesn't matter. Whatever.
Right. Or Jennifer Love Hewitt is losing it, but they don't really pursue that line of thought.
No. Also, this guy has just too much time on his hands. For me, group of kids, they think they killed me and I'm going to like go back and get revenge. I'm just going to kill them and get on with my day.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially this is 1 year after a hit and run. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it lines up. I don't think the priorities of an adult line up.
Because if you're just going to kill them anyway, why do you care that they think you're going to kill them half? Like, if you just kill them. I just don't have time for this. I think that's why I'd be a bad killer, because I just don't.
Ain't nobody got time for that.
Who's got the time? Who's got the time for this?
So the mention of that particular death, Ryan Phillippe is confident Freddie Prinze Jr. is behind this. So it must be one of the four. One of the five people who know that this happened. One is dead. It's got to be one of the other four. He assumes it's Freddie Prinze Jr., at which point he lunges at him and punches him with the same hand that was broken and is in a cast.
You're going to die.
Hey! Hey! Stop it!
Look, what are you doing?
Stop it!
I didn't do anything! You're fucking lying. He's lying!
Leave him alone, Barry. Get a grip.
No, wake up, Julie. He's behind this. How many fucked up fishermen are out there?
Look, he's after me, too. I got a letter.
Oh, you got a letter. I got run over. Helen gets her hair chopped up. Julie gets a body in a trunk, and you get a letter? That's...
Following that moment, yeah, what you were talking about, Freddie Prinze Jr. kind of acting as if he can't read and everything. His mouth is open a lot during this movie. He is just yes. kind of astounded by most things.
And he's got those eyebrows. I mean, he's adorable. Don't get me wrong. But like, you're just like, those eyebrows are constantly like up in a questioning sort of dog. Like if he was a dog, he would be like a pug dog that tilts their head when their owner talks to them and then tilts it the other way because they don't speak English, you know?
So I guess kicking into the third act, we've got some murders, and we start really putting them together. There's of all the places to take a chase scene, when Sarah Michelle Gellar winds up in a dumbwaiter in the building where she's working, like the family store is kind of like a general clothing and perfume store. And it just kind of hits that moment. Like, just talking about the general sense that this movie doesn't really build momentum very well. When it literally has a chase scene and it arrives at a point where she finds, like, the best mode of escape is to get inside a dumbwaiter and then pull the ropes and then keep pulling the ropes. And 15 minutes later, you might be somewhere.
Yeah, it's never a good idea. No. Never a good idea. This is a horror movie no-no. Never get in the dumbwaiter.
I think there was a dumbwaiter scene in Halloween H2O. I think that was a little quicker. I think that's more of just a reveal.
Well, there's that terrifying one, The Haunting of Hill House, the remake, the TV show.
Yeah, that was good. And that kind of made perfect use.
Terrifying.
That made perfect use of that, of like being stranded by the dumbwaiter. So one of my favorite dumb things in movies, and sometimes in horror movies, comes up at the end of this. So there's a showdown. Of course, it's on a fishing boat. Where else would this story...
You're in a fishing village, Darren. God damn.
Where else could the story end mercifully?
Didn't you see they're wearing J. Crew? It should tell you. Oh, wait. Is crew because of sailing? But wait, is it called J. Crew because of like a boat, like a crew? Is it meant to be like that?
I would assume so, based on like the sort of like boat shoe aesthetic.
I just put that together. Literally, it was today years old.
I think a lot of that kind of... Well, crew also like... Say like rowing is crew, and that's all kind of
yeah,
New England.
I didn't get it.
Yeah, it's kind of New England preppy.
Well, I learned
Martha's
something today.
Martha's Vineyard-esque. But yeah, so back to this fishing boat and this showdown. Jennifer Love Hewitt does what I'm saying is one of my like most maddening things to see in a movie is when she pops up and sees that there's a fella she likes. He's in danger because he's in the middle of a fight, and she's so overcome with seeing him in a fight that she screams his name out of concern. And then he turns and looks at this screaming woman, at which point the killer is like, this is the perfect time to punch that guy in the head.
It happens so often.
That's distraction.
Like, you're
almost
not helping.
Killed.
Don't do it.
It's so dumb. It really just is like a moment where like we need a scream. We need him to be incapacitated. How are we going to do that? Have her scream and distract him. That it was so dumb. It was so dumb.
Girlfriends, stop distracting your boyfriends when they're getting murdered. Don't yell out their name. It doesn't help anybody. She should have yelled at the fisherman.
Yeah, that would have been good. You know what? Don't yell. Sneak up. Because even if she yells at the fisherman, the boyfriend at that point can still look at her and be like, oh my God, she's alive. That's great. Or any reaction is going to take him off his game.
That's true. It's like when you yell duck and then someone just turn instead of ducking.
Yeah, so this movie kind of ends on a fishing trawler. And then there's two sequels, only one of which actually involves any of this cast. And I Still Know What You Did Last Summer. It's like the Brady Bunch going to Hawaii. Like they just changed scenery and kept the same dumb story going. And that was really... I don't know. I've seen bits and pieces of it and it's stupid.
I didn't even go after the 2006 one because I watched I Still Know What You Did Last Summer.
Oh, you did?
But there was one in 2006 and it's like, what? The people who would have been your prime bread and butter watchers for the 97, 98 films are probably not going to watch it again because they're going to realize it wasn't that good to begin with.
No, and there's nothing familiar to latch onto. I'm assuming there's a killer fisherman who's got nothing to do with anything. But yeah, I mean, we talked about it before that like the aesthetic of the killer fisherman is not really what we're coming to this movie for. We want to see pretty teenagers.
Exactly. I want to see Ryan Phillippe. I want to see Buffy. I want to see some cool clothes and hair. That's the 90s.
So we're done talking about this one and we're certainly not going to give any major spoilers while we're talking in the main section. However, after a sort of post-credits segments, we're going to do spoilers corner and talk about the specifics of this. So that'll do it for I Know What You Did Last Summer. Mindy, where do you land overall? Would you recommend this movie in general, not to a specific horror audience, but would you recommend this?
I would recommend it. If you want to see something that is the heart of 90s teen horror slasher, whatever you want to call it, I Know What You Did Last Summer. It's a great jumping off point.
I wonder who gets a hankering for 90s teen horror. Well, I guess
people
it is nostalgic.
Do.
Yeah.
We have a listener, Tony, one of our listeners and friends of the show, and our, you know, he loves 90s horror.
And our listener, Josh Tonks, is a big fan of Sarah Michelle Gellar and the Buffy era 90s WB throwback.
Yeah, see? So some people are fans. People love 90s horror.
I wonder what it... You know what? Maybe in another 10 years, I will kind of look back and think of it more fondly. But I don't know. As a effective horror movie, it does feel a little forced. We did mention how this was Kevin Williamson's earlier work before he wrote Scream, so he's kind of like polishing the tools. I think the dialogue is generally there, even if the acting isn't always.
Yes.
But yeah, there's promising elements to it. I think it definitely deserves a place when it's talking about 90s horror classics. And when we come back in 2 weeks, we're going to be talking about Urban Legend and The Faculty.
Yay!
Which I think of as like peak 90s. This really, when we talked about like the branding and the synergy in terms of like getting the actors to wear the right wardrobe and sell the right music. And it's really just, it's a package that that teenagers are going to the mall to buy.
I certainly was. My goodness, Clea Duvall, yes, please, thank you. Whatever she's wearing, whatever she's doing, I was all about it.
That's interesting. That's a conversation coming up. I was going to ask you who you relate to, because it does kind of throw back to the Breakfast Club as far as every trope is there. Every character is accounted for. Listener, if you're feeling generous, you might find us on the streaming app or wherever you found us, whether it's Stitcher or Google Play Music or iTunes or Spotify. And drop us a couple stars and a review. Your reviews help us to grow and share the show. Yeah, drop us a line, drop us some stars, some reviews.
And feel free to tweet us on Twitter. Love getting tweets. And then you could always send us an email, therancemacabre@gmail.com.
So see you again in 2 weeks. That'll do it for me. This is Darren signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
The Rance Macabre. Cutting,
cultured,
and curated.
And curated. And curated. Curated.
It's a shame. Being it's 4th of July and all. Kids like you should be out having fun. Drinking. Partying. Running people over. Getting away with murder. Things like that.
Welcome to Spoilers Corner. Let's get some things off our chest. Okay, so Johnny Galecki, David from Roseanne, and whoever from Big Bang Theory, is the first one to die. However, completely like removed from this storyline. And I read there was one final point that I found very late in the game that explained why he might die at all. And considering he is the like prime suspect until he dies, one would think that like killing him doesn't make any sense. Why would the killer even know who he is?
Right.
But he must follow our teenagers because he's tracking them at all times because he's got shit to pull out of their trunk at different times, I suppose. But so he must follow them where Ryan Phillippe kind of threatens and assaults, David from Roseanne, and must connect those dots that like, oh, they must have something to do with each other. They must know, but even that's kind of a leap in logic because he's killing an innocent at this point. Like, if anything, like, that guy is going to be on your side because he hates these rich kids and, you know.
But he kills lots of innocent people that have nothing to do with anything.
Lots of? You mean like the sister? There's just the one, isn't there?
Yeah, that's true. Well, and then in the very beginning, the guy he kills from the very beginning who they thought they killed.
You're right. You're right. And so that takes me into this other point. Well, okay, so before we get there, so we talked about it in the main segment that, all right, so this guy should really give up murder because he's kind of half-assing it and start his cleanup job. Like, he should be either a crime scene cleanup or just on the spot, you know, house cleaner kind of guy, because the quick change to get David out of the trunk with crabs in his mouth, I kind of assumed what? He's got to be on top of a tarp with, like, clearly marked corners, right?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, he has to have Viz Queen. It's like Viz Queen, and he's probably got like, then he can just like wrap him up real nice and neat. That's what I think. But at the same time, he's in the middle of the suburbs in the middle of the day.
Yeah, right. Okay, so now he's got to throw up one tarp to block his view, block traffic from seeing what he's doing. And then he's got to use his other good tarp underneath the guy and the crabs and yank it all out in one stroke. And then so later when he kills Ryan Phillippe's character, Barry, right? I think it's Barry.
That is Barry. Yes, it's Barry.
When he kills him in the balcony of the town's like little concert center where they do the pageants, he does a pretty great cleanup job then. I mean, a cursory, we get a glimpse at some dripping blood, but as far as a cop looking over a general like floor area and goes, nothing happened up here and goes away, that's a pretty good quick cleanup job.
Yeah, those are kind of Wes Craven's kind of cops, though, where they're terrible, you know?
Yeah, I guess they're
like kind of the bumbling local cop.
Yeah, they weren't really of any use. They certainly didn't play a big part, and they certainly didn't investigate.
Oh, there's another random. That's another random person he kills. He kills the cop.
In the car, right before Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Yeah, so we've got three randoms.
Yeah, all right.
And then the guy at the beginning.
So I guess just grief struck and mad, this guy is lashing out entirely. And so who this guy is might be the reason I kind of loathe parts of this movie.
Julie, what are you doing here?
We didn't kill David Egan. It was someone else on the road that night.
What are you talking about?
I think it was Susie's father, Ben Willis. He's a fisherman.
But they found David's body in the water.
Yeah, I know, but I think Ben Willis killed David Egan.
Wait a second. You think this Willis guy killed David, then we killed him?
Yeah, but what if he didn't die, Ray? What if he's still alive?
It gets ridiculously convoluted to the point where, like, characters are giving full exposition and then having to repeat it just because it came so late in the story.
Because Ray can't read. Yes.
So our group of four think they killed a townie named David Egan. That's Anne Heche's character's brother. She let J-Love know that David was really bummed out because it was the anniversary of his girlfriend Susie's death. He's kind of playing with like a charm that looks like a spur, like a boot spur, but it's got her name on it. Yeah, he's pretty bummed out about it the summer after. So that's David and his girlfriend, Susie. Turns out Susie died that year before in an accident that David is blamed for. Susie's dad blames David. So young lovers, we've got one dead, one survived the next summer until the father, who is Ben Willis. This is all.
Yes.
This really bugs me. Okay. So Ben Willis is the father of Susie, who's already dead. Ben Willis kills David Egan for killing his daughter. Not long after, Ben Willis, the dad, is walking in the middle of the fucking Pacific Coast Highway and gets hit by a car full of teenagers. Okay, so they see him. His face is covered with blood. Although, even covered with blood, I don't know. I'd be able to tell the difference between a teenager and a 47-year-old fisherman.
Right.
But I'm not a detective in that context. So they essentially did a public good. Like it was, they assaulted a murderer.
That's what really pisses me off. This kind of pisses me off about the movie, though, is like, because if this guy wasn't a murderer, these kids are the worst. You know what I'm saying? They just literally got lucky that the guy that they murdered was a bad guy.
Right. And it completely, like, the idea that all of these kids are dealing with post-traumatic stress, and for some of them, it's ruining their lives. And like I said, you know, one's steering towards alcoholism and the other one's stuck in a job and one's failing out of college. Like, that is all, like, pretty severe spiraling shit. And then to find out that, like, oh, well, you don't have to feel too bad. First of all, you didn't kill him. And second of all, he was a horrible person. Like, what are you doing? This is not good writing.
Exactly. And that's what's great about the end, though. Once they discover all this stuff, then, like, they go back to school or whatever they're doing, and then their lives are awesome.
Right. Yeah, no, she looks like the...
She's so
happy.
Yeah,
it's a glamour episode of Party of Five.
It's like that year never happened of crippling depression. And she's just like, it's all sunshine and rainbows. And it's like, I mean, you'd still probably carry some of that weight around with you, but I guess not.
I mean, it would cheer me up if I thought for a whole year that I had killed somebody and then they're like, nah, you didn't really kill him. And anyway, he was a mean guy. He's probably, you know, he probably deserves to be hit by a car.
It's just so, like, it is actually really pisses you off when you're watching it. You're like, wait a second. Do what? You know, like, you literally go, what? And there's so many, like, I felt like Ray many times because I was like, wait, what's happening?